Welcome back to the Special Ed Strategist podcast, where we bridge learning gaps and empower families to access the special education services they need. I am your host, Wendy Taylor, and I'm thrilled to kick off season 3 with you. Our podcast is your go-to resource for special education, offering expert insights, inspiring stories, and actionable tips to help your child thrive. In this season, we'll dive deeper into the world of special education. So whether you're a parent, educator, or passionate advocate, join us in this journey. To make this season unforgettable, please like, listen, and subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. Your support helps us reach more families and create a stronger, more inclusive future. So hit that subscribe button, join our community, and let's make season 3 a game changer. Thanks to listeners like you. Hello and welcome to our show today. I'm excited to talk about a very important topic that I don't think gets enough street credit, and that is transition planning. So I'm going to welcome our guest, Tom, today. I'm going to have him give us some introduction and then we're going to dive right in. Tom, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much, Wendy. Thanks for the opportunity. I am Tom Liniak and I'm many things. So we'll go through a few of them. I'm an attorney. I am a proud parent of a son with autism who is now a young adult. And for the last 18 years, I've dedicated all my efforts really to helping people with disabilities realize their potential, first in instructional sports and socialization through a nonprofit that I co-founded. And for the last 15 years, over on the side of disability employment. And I'm honored and proud of the fact that I've been part of close to 900 job placements, which 86% of them were still there after a year, even more important. And, you know, again, a whole group of people that in many ways were doubted, and I was able to empower them to realize their potential. Last but not least, as a parent and as a professional in this field, I began to recognize that adult services and moving from the school system to adulthood for sons and daughters with autism and families was incredibly overwhelming, incredibly daunting. All this information is not in one spot. So a couple of years ago, I started a business called Disability Transition Support, and I offer customized consulting to help people understand, not make mistakes, and maximize the transition to adulthood. And then as you get to adulthood, really maximize outcomes for the rest of your life.
And it's so incredibly important for this conversation today, because you kind of in your intro pointed out really two things, right? So we have our transition planning that takes place for our students that have IEPs, and ensuring, or the purpose behind it, to ensure that they are successful in transitioning from the school setting to adult. But I think where we have a lot of questions is, well, first we're going to dive into what does that look like? What does that mean, that transition planning? But the adult services that are available to families, and what does disability employment look like? And so let's just talk about the importance of transition planning first. So what does that look like, and why is that so crucial for their future?
I'm going to answer it backwards. It is so important because, again, the school bus isn't coming anymore. And you know, all the services aren't in one meeting. And we move from an entitlement-based system where you're entitled to a free and appropriate education to a needs-based system. And not all of the supports or aids are found in one spot. So it is, as I say, a bit of a daunting discovery process to understand even what is available, what might apply to, you know, your son or daughter. And then start understanding not just the individual pieces, but put them into an overall picture and put them into a timing picture. Because everybody talks about transition from the school system, which is a big one. And, it, you know, these individuals are going to spend decades out of the school system. And most of them spent, you know, anywhere from 13 to 18 years in the school system. So all of a sudden, what about 36 years, 40 years out of the school system? Time says this is very important. The other thing is, these are young people. And just like all of us, they are going to go through more transitions than leaving school. They will become adults. They will have successes. They will have challenges. And you know, the concern of every parent is at some point parents won't be there. So it's fundamentally important to understand and maximize support so that individuals can really be empowered and live as full life as possible.
So then where would a parent start, right? So we're talking about transition planning usually starts kind of as students are in middle school going towards high school. Can you tell us, you know, how would a parent approach that versus once they get out of school to that needs-based approach?
Yeah, I think the first place, of course, is to many times it's just not done, or it's not done, even though, you know, the IEPs and the IEP process talks about, you know, having a transition plan. And, you know, I work with many people who really don't have one and weren't aware that they should have one. And they also don't know what it should look like. So, you know, I help people out a lot with that because, you know, starting early in anything and starting step by step is always going to be the best way. So I think you really want to bring it into that IEP meeting and you want to, you know, insist that that issue is addressed. And, you know, there are a lot of things about transition. One is hopefully building blocks towards employment, but the other is building blocks towards being as independent as possible and prosperous as possible in adult life. And that could be socially, safety-wise, advocacy, whatever it's going to be. So I think early on, requiring that there be a plan, that there are very specific goals, and particularly people who are in certificate programs, you know, talking about where will I be afforded opportunities to begin practicing work tasks, work skills. Because again, this is a learn by doing art. That's how all it works.
You know, and if you think about the crux of our law, right, the whole goal is to help guide students towards that future independence, education, and employment. So what would a solid transition plan look like?
Solid transition plan should begin talking about developing independence, developing advocacy, developing social skills, and then should work towards exposure to actual work and, you know, doing actual work hands-on. And I think these are the keys. The other component of it is to understand through your transition teacher, you know, outside agencies, because, for example, Maryland Department of Rehab Services, as of age 14, now that is not the school system, but as of age 14, and typically most people access it around age 16, you could begin doing some preliminary training, could be hands-on internship training, it could be advocacy training, it could be, and these are things that you can build in addition to what's happening. And the transition teacher should be able to guide you to Maryland doors to be able to help get that set up. So that's something that, you know, again, would be a good thing to require.
Do all states have an equivalent to like a Maryland version of what it looks like for support in adulthood?
They do. I mean, there are, you know, we talk about a lot of different supports. So the primary supports in Maryland and other states are for those that qualify, you know, Maryland DDA, which is home and community-based services. It could be a combination of services. It could be employment, could be housing, could be assistance in the home or assistance in your own place of living. Could be medical assistance. It really comes under Medicaid. And, you know, the funding for all that harkens back to a time when people were put in institutions. And, you know, decades ago, thank God, it was split out. Now, not everybody qualifies for that. Another one, of course, and this is where we get into the, there are multiple choices here. Sometimes instead of, sometimes in addition to, Maryland Doors, another Maryland program. Well, Maryland Doors is a shorter term program, typically months up to a year, with one primary focus, work training, ultimately work placement, and hopefully work retention. Amidst all of that, there, of course, is also Social Security, which is something that as people turn 18, they should be thinking about applying for, both in terms of financial assistance, but, you know, medical insurance assistance as well. And there are all manner of other programs, not the least of which would be housing vouchers, these kind of things. Again, if your income is zero or not very high, you may be able to access a program that basically would allow you to, you know, have some contribution so that you could live in your own place.
I know there's a lot of different programs, right? But what would that qualification tend to look like? I know there's probably a lot of variables that go into that, but what would a qualifying student, what are the parameters?
Yeah. And again, it's somewhat varies program by program. Parameter number one is somebody must have a disability that is going to affect their ability to really prosper, be it in employment or in life. And then you get into kind of the gray area of, you know, who qualifies there, who doesn't. When you go over to the Maryland DORS side, the more help they believe you need, the quicker you will be served. If you are on the DEA side, everybody gets served at the same time if they qualify. But then it's a matter of saying, well, my program might be just employment. Your program might be employment, help in the home. It might be housing as well. And, you know, again, it's a matter of understanding what's there and what the qualifications are for each one. But to start with disability, the more challenge that it creates in all these aspects of life, the more likely you are to get services or a broader array of services.
So what are some practical steps parents can take to start that transition planning for their kiddo and still kind of keeping things stress-free?
While keeping it stress-free, that's a tough one. I live that one too. And this is, you know, what I've been doing for a living for a long time. So lower stress probably is the more accurate way to put it. I think, you know, really understanding, you know, kind of what you're after. And, you know, as parents, I think a lot of times, whether it's child disability or not, we do things for people, not meaning to, either because we are in a hurry or we're trying to be nice. But, you know, giving individuals tasks in the home, whether it is, you know, double step tasks, taking out the trash, emptying the dishwasher, putting away dishes, you know, these kind of things are very important because these are the basics and these are the building blocks of work and independence and being on your own. So there's the in the home aspect. The other piece, like I say, is to begin to educate yourself about the individual components and try to understand, you know, what is and is not in terms of qualification, these kind of things. Part of that can be through the school transition teacher. Part of it can be, like most things in life, the good news is it doesn't all need to be done at once. So if you start early, you will feel less stressed. You will feel less overwhelmed. You still may need to end up talking to someone like me or, you know, to say, I've sat in these things, but they just don't connect. Or how do they connect for my child? The people that come to me typically say, and these are very smart people, but they just don't do this every day. And like I said, because it comes from multiple sources, it's kind of hard to digest. And their main thing is, how do I make sure that I don't make a mistake? And also, how do I make sure that I am, you know, turning over the stones and maximizing that which is legitimately available for my child? So not a bad idea to intersect with someone once. I think immerse first, go early and understand. If your child is 14 or 16 or whatever, and you don't understand everything, it's okay. Start here and then begin to pick up some vocabulary, begin to pick up some general, and then, you know, maybe talking to someone, you know, about painting this picture for yourself, but one bite at a time.
Absolutely. And is part of that, you know, you know what you don't know. And that when you're thinking about your kid, when it comes to that future education, employment, and independence, what does that look like for each child is very different. And starting early to start that plan, I always talk about with families in terms of with their parent input statement, think about where you see your child 6 months from now, a year from now, 3 years, 5 years, so that those conversations can start early and that you have it outlined in that student's IEP so that you can start to connect with the folks like yourself or folks in the school team to ensure that applications are put in and so forth. Would you say that's correct?
Right. Because I mean, you know, there's certain milestone times, you know, like Social Security, you can't apply for until you're 18. So You're 14, don't worry about it. You know, beginning to get some internship early work training, you can begin to access it at age 14. Do you need to necessarily? You don't, you know, but somewhere in that 14 to 16, think about it. It's some steps along the way. And frankly, you can get some of these things out of the way early. So Maryland DDA, you could apply anytime. You do not need to wait till your child is, you know, walking out on the last day of school. And I would not recommend that. Again, if there are some things you can get done early and just be eligible for those services, it's just another thing, you know, to get out of the way.
What are some misconceptions or misunderstandings that parents may have about transition planning?
Sadly, a lot of people think it's very orderly and defined, and it isn't. So that's not good news. And like I say, you truly have to be your own advocate, you know, when it comes to a transition plan. School IEPs are more often focused, and this is where an educational advocate can really be helpful to you, because, you know, that transition plan is important and may continue to become even more important than this class that someone is taking next semester. So I think that's thing number one. There are a lot of, you know, secondhand anecdotal stories. And, you know, what is this whole employment thing? What happens? You know, there's not a parallel universe. You know, if people are going to work, they're going to work as my coworker, your coworker. And, you know, they may well get support to do that, support to make sure that they're ready to go there, that they learn, that they stay there. You know, in 15 years in disability employment, you know, everybody comes in and we have to talk about what the child wants. And we have to talk about, you know, we have to talk about abilities of the child when it comes to the workforce. So my own son, you know, John is a talented guy, but there's a lot of people say, well, I want him to work in an office, okay, which is fine. And then I will say, what skills does he have today that, you know, you believe would be kind of at market level that an employer would pay for? And people will say, well, he can shred paper, you know, and shredding paper is not really a job, you know, the per se. So understanding that there is no ceiling. And, you know, my first job was in the stockroom of a shoe store. I'll tell you what, I learned how work works there. I also learned I didn't want to stay there, you know, but at the time it was great. So, you know, try to look at the parallels in your career or another child who doesn't have a disability and understand that your educational journey has been step by step. And this adult transition in, you know, life is going to be step by step as well. And it's okay because we've got time to get where we want to get. And like I say, just because you hear second or third hand that, well, I have a friend who works for the federal government and he doesn't do anything and he makes X thousand dollars, you know, since I don't know who you're talking about, I can't comment, but I can tell you generally that that doesn't exist, you know, because I've never been able to find an employer who said, I'd like to pay people minimum wage to multiples of minimum wage. And here's the deal. You come, you really don't do anything. You do whatever you want. And if you have skills, fine. If you don't, fine. And we're all happy. So we want to stay grounded. As we stay grounded, that doesn't mean we extinguish possibility. In my own son, people said, not sure if he's going to be able to work. Maybe, probably. He can. He does. He's the best at what he does. He's valued. And so it works, but we need to be, it's hard, a little bit patient.
Can we just talk a little bit, you know, you talk about employment and we talk about placement and training and retention. What are our options? What are parents' options for thinking of those things? And when should they start kind of planning that process?
It's going to be kind of individual. There's some commonalities, but it's individual. You know, I've worked with people who have had degrees, multiple degrees, advanced degrees. I've worked with people who have high school certificates, you know, just depends. So there's a broad range of people. But again, some years ago, and, you know, I spent a lot of time working on committees trying to bring this to Maryland, and it worked out. The notion that you can start doing internship, that you can start on-site work training, learning how work works, this is a whole nother social environment. This is not school. And it's not, you're not even in a classroom. So it's a big frontier, you know, And, you know, for my son works in a 160,000 square foot facility. And you might think, wow, someone with autism, that's a lot of sensory input. How the heck does that ever work? And it works phenomenally, but it's different than sitting in a classroom in school, and it's far more independent. So we train that, we teach that. These internships for pre-employment training, I think, are key. And they're also, we've worked with a lot of people who have done college, be it Montgomery College, four-year college, master's degree. Some of them found a real home in college. They loved college, and I loved college too. Some don't want to leave college, and that's hard to fund because going to college is not a job, ultimately. No one pays you for it. And I think the key is, again, as you're going down your educational pathway, that could be certificate, it could be diploma, it could be college or beyond, mix that with practical experience, because whatever that educational piece, whatever that skill set is, in the long run, we want to use it in a workplace. So I think doing these things in parallel are quite important along the way. And I mean, you know, my other son, again, when he went to college, you know, experiential learning is now part of almost every college curriculum. I mean, I think it's good.
Can you give us some examples of how you have seen pre-employment training work? What would that look like? What could families ask for so that they have a better sense of what is available?
You know, some of it is classroom, and you really got to think about your child. Does your child learn from words in the air, you know, or staring at the Promethean board or whatever they're going to have? The ones that I think are ultimately either after that or right away even more valuable are the ones that literally put you on site at an employer. And the key and the best providers really are the people that put you in these situations, and they train you to work standard. So you might go to a deli, and I work with a deli in Rockville, and you also have a mail order, like it's not mail order, but internet, you know, cookie business, and they ship around the country. And we worked with them on aspects of that. But what we would do is we would, if a paid job there or in another place would be 8 tasks, we first take two or three. And we teach you how to do those to work standard. And we don't worry about speed, because if you can't do it right, we don't speed up.
Right.
Once you get those and you get independent on that, then we talk about maybe another task. Then we talk about, okay, now you have work performance standard. Now we have to move to saying, okay, to get paid at this, instead of doing 10 units per time period, you'd need to move to 15. And, you know, progressively try and move up the case. I wouldn't be too worried. You know, I get asked a lot too. It's like, well, my son loves computers and everybody wants to go to ZeniMax over here. And they said, I want to be a video game tester. And that's what I want to do. And it's like, a lot of people want to do that, especially if they ever got paid to do it. You know, it's like a beta version of a game and you try and break it, right? But again, this is work. So it's about how are we matching skills to that? And I wouldn't be too worried in the first exposure to this. Again, back to my shoe store example. In the first instance, we're trying to learn a little bit of the environment, the social interaction, and how work works. If you don't have that down, then we can never move to whatever it is you're interested in move forward. Because when you hire people, they need the skills, but they also need to be able to do it in a workplace independently and deal with other people, be they customers or coworkers or whatever it's going to be. So again, let's take one thing at a time. Work on, you know, kind of how work works. Are you on time? Are you, you know, do you have hygiene? You know, is your hair combed? You are now representative of the brand of that business, and it matters. And people make decisions in hiring and who moves forward based on things like that. So let's get those out of the way first, add education, add experience, and then we can go, you know, to subject matter second.
And that's, I think, incredibly important for us as parents to think about in terms of that skill building that you explained, right? In terms of hygiene and culture and some of the elements to a workforce that will be crucial for success for our students that are entering the workforce.
Yeah. And I mean, I think, look, you know, you're used to being in school.
Yeah.
And somebody else says something in school, you might very quickly respond or say something. And you know, the social interaction in the workplace, hopefully, you know, might be a little different. So you've got to be at times a little more measured. If a supervisor asks you to do a task or to switch, and you know, it's some of your stated tasks, you know, we don't want to, you know, be upset. We don't want to have a meltdown. We don't want to say, oh, you know, I don't want to do that. You know, we've got to move from perhaps the school home piece to understand that we're working in a different social environment, and it's a work social environment, and it can still be fun. And it doesn't mean you can't express your opinion. It just means you might have to do it a little different way.
Can you give us some insight on, you know, we talked about employment a little bit, and we talked about transitioning to employment and how to do that. How would parents get support for that independent living piece if that is part of their story?
Same process. Again, the supports for helping you understand what's out there, the supports for helping you, you know, move to a living situation outside the home and supporting you typically come under Maryland DDA. So again, you would be applying. In the first instance, you are deemed to be eligible or not eligible for DDA services. Then there's a whole scope of services, from housing to, you know, personal assistance to employment to many other things. If you are eligible, then you want to come into a person-centered plan. And, you know, what does that person want? Well, maybe not today, but they'd like to have a job. They'd like to one day move out of their parents' house. They would like to be able to function in that housing in a way that's safe, in a way that, you know, a lot to learn about having your own place, you know. So that's where in the PCP, we start with the goals of the person. So the PCP being the adult DDA equivalent of the IEP. Everything's got a P in it and everything's got initials, but that's just the way it goes. But understanding that there is a broad array of possibilities that, you know, fit under this umbrella, and we follow that which the person, you know, wants. And then we start measuring to say, well, are they totally independent? That transportation is another one, which is, you know, how is that person going to transport themselves but for mom and dad giving them a ride? And, you know, having people assist you with that, train you with that, whatever that's going to be. It could be public transportation. There's a myriad of services, from metro access to ride and call to all sorts of point-to-point things, you know. And that really comes into that meeting. And again, understanding and advocating for the broad array of what you're after.
What are kind of the steps for housing? What does that support look like?
Supports for that. The first thing, there's a new under DDA called Housing Support Services. So something under Maryland's new waiver got approved. And what that is meant to do is give you a guide or an advocate just to paint this whole picture. Because what is this universe? What are the possibilities? And that program is only a couple of years old, but it's actually it's pretty darned effective in its rollout, especially as a new rollout. To educate people, the second thing it does is looks at different supports or housing credits, housing vouchers that you might be able to qualify for. If you do, basically working with you to apply for all those, because many of those have a wait length. Your number does not come up immediately. And it could be a year, it could be 3 years, you know, this kind of thing. So again, timing of saying no interest today, but it's like, well, is there some interest in a 3 year window? Okay, we should put that in. And then, you know, really talking about what's important for you, you know, the where, the what type, balanced against what do you do? You know, can you walk out your door and access things and be independent, you know, or do you need a ride everywhere you go? You know, is it far away from things that you might want to do and your job? So you look at everything else. And then, like I say, within supports, once you're in that housing situation, then, you know, helping to teach you about safety, cooking, cleaning, you know, all manner of things to be safe and prosper.
Is there supported housing for individuals? And if so, what does that look like?
So years ago, it was always a group home model. And, you know, it started when people, you know, moved from institutions. It was the group home, and you had four people, six people, and with disabilities, and they lived in the group home. There are still some group homes, although, you know, federal and state policy and legislation has moved largely away from, you know, the group home model, because it really was not all that integrated. And now housing is kind of a broad array, but it looks a lot like, you know, an apartment building that you drive by every day, and being one of the residents of that apartment building, maybe with a roommate, maybe not. In some situations, the other thing is, it might be in that complex that there are actually eight units that have individuals with disabilities. And with the providers and this kind of thing, sometimes you can have really an additional social component, because now you're not the only person, you know, in that building, but you've got, you know, some buddies, and they get together maybe once a week or whatever it is to do things that everybody else does too. So
in terms of, you had mentioned personal assistance, what does that look like?
It falls under the category of personal supports, and it really, that is kind of assistance to make sure that, you know, say you like to swim or go to the gym, but, you know, you need assistance getting there, and you need assistance, you know, to be able to kind of carry that out effectively. That would be making sure that that social piece gets done, because it's important to you, in a safe manner. And then all manner of things, you know, within a living unit. So, you know, everything from teaching people to, well, they need food, you know, how to shop, you know, how to cook, how to look at expiration labels, you know, which is an important thing, you know, and do all the things that we all have to do, you know, laundry, vacuum, these kind of things. So part of it's social, to carry out non-work activities, and part of it to make sure that things run well and smoothly inside a living arrangement.
There is, so it's called Community Living Experience, CLE, and that allows students to transition. They're taking coursework. They're also learning to live independently. Are there other resources available for families if they're not necessarily in an area where something like CLE is? Or have you heard of other options for students to be able to have that social support, school support, and independent living support kind of under one roof?
Yeah, it is. Once you come, if you come into the DDA system, then yes, you can build it off the DDA system. If you're not in the DDA system, then it really, you know, comes back to kind of a private pay model, where you would have to be bringing in, you know, your own resources to do that. You know, when you go to various colleges, you know, some are quite prolific in terms of their disability support staff programs. Some of it's academic, a lot of it's living, you know, to make sure that people have the assistance they need in the situation they need to be able to do well.
So for families that are trying to figure out what makes sense for their kiddo, are there any type of transition assessments that could, or that you're able to tell us about, you know, what types of assessments are used and how they can help create that well-informed transition plan?
Yeah, you know, there are a lot of assessments out there, but a lot of them have value or high value only for a small amount of individuals. Because on the career side, you certainly, and again, if you go into doors on a pre-employment program, one of the things you can get is a career assessment. All right. So what they're going to do is they're going to try and figure out what you like, what you don't like, and part through testing and part through hands-on, kind of develop a profile that you are good at certain things. And it's not necessarily, they don't put you outside and say, change the tire, you know, although they could. But it really is seeing, you know, are you good visually? Do you recognize patterns? Can you remember things? You know, this kind of thing. And it's, you know, that it's meant to discover abilities, not to say, oh, you know, you're at X grade level. You know, it's not really what the point is. I think those can be helpful for some. Some of the effectiveness of it gets lost with words in the air, words on a page, where, you know, they could hands-on do a lot more than they might be able to show through a piece of paper or verbally articulating it. That's where I think that the internships that I'm talking about and through Maryland Doors and the work-based learning experiences through school, you know, have people do some hands-on learning and, you know, kind of see what shows through, you know, where can they show independence, where can they show skill? Because these are clues and very important clues as to pathways that we can take advantage of and start saying, well, you know, these kind of skills are kind of critical for these kind of jobs. I've had people, you know, a lot of people I've had who had autism, there's a fair number who have been extremely visually capable and they can spot differences and aberrations far beyond what I could ever hope to do. And that skews towards a certain kind of job, you know, where that's kind of a superpower. So we try to figure out, or memory, you know. Now, on the one hand, you know, just memorizing things rote is not necessarily great. But, you know, if you're working for, I had a situation with a young man and he worked for a diesel parts, truck parts distributor. And he had computer skills and he had great visual memory skills. And this was the job for him. He could tell differences in anything. And literally in the first, I think it was 2 months he was there, he found them $250,000 worth of inventory they didn't know they had. Because he said, the computer's wrong. It says we have 22 of these. We have six, or we have 48. And also, by the way, these are in the wrong spot. So we'd be buying more of these things because they got put back in the wrong spot. So you think about these kind of background skills and how they might map into something to be very valuable.
As our young people transition to higher education or employment, what specific accommodations would that student need?
Very individual. Let's take, you know, higher education, you know, and I mean, there's the academic based, you know, accommodations, which might be such as, you know, extra time, taking your test, you know, in a, you know, a less distracting environment, you know, could be note taking, could be a lot of different things, could be a piece of technology. On the living side in college, again, it could be, you know, your living situation. Does that mean you're going to be better off in a single room? Does that mean that you're going to be better off, you know, really to be your best in a certain kind of living arrangement? Also plugging you into, you know, some social pieces or, you know, kind of a go-to facilitator for these kind of things. For the workplace, again, and this is where there's a bit of disconnect among parents too, because they'll say, well, you know, my child was in college and he got double the time and a lighter workload. So I want that in work. And that is not a workplace accommodation to either, you know, do half the job or do it half as fast. What you can find in the workplace is, first and foremost, you can have a job coach, and that could be done well, incredibly valuable, because that's that adjunct trainer. That's that person that connects you. That's that person that, you know, helps you learn this whole, how's this whole system work? You know, beyond that, if you're an employer, sometimes will be willing to, if you're good at 7 of 8 things, sometimes they'll say, that's okay. We'll take you. You're phenomenal at 7. And the fact that you, number 8 is not going to work for you is okay. They don't have to do that. It's not an accommodation, but it is something that, you know, you can kind of ask and see if it could be customized. There are any manner of technology pieces that could be used too. You know, we have a lot of people that use kind of the simplest functions of smartwatches, and probably something we all could use. So we disable pretty much everything else on the watch, except for jobs when people need a reminder to do something. It just buzzes on their wrist and it's a text. It says, do this or remember that. Or, you know, say if you're responsible for all the studios, responsible for 6 studios on a schedule in a gym, instead of telling you, we have people that have a hard time with functional time. They can stare at a clock until it's 10 o'clock all day. But the executive function of putting that together to say, that means I have to do X. And before that, I've got to think about getting things 10 minutes early. Well, we take the mystery out of it. So the accommodation really is to put it on the watch. And instead of telling them it's 10 o'clock, it says Studio 1. Or it says Studio 1 green towel, which happens to be maybe a microfiber. And once they're in motion with it, they press it and it goes away. So These are more common kind of accommodations that you'll see in the workplace. And again, they do differ, and that's a big kind of misconception between school and work.
And who would be the guide of that to help a family kind of come up with some strategies or help guide them of to what's available? Who is?
So if they have either Maryland DORS or Maryland DDA or both, it would be basically the people working in employment services for those agencies would be the facilitators of that. If for any reason they do not have that support, then there's always going to be either a disability services person or advocate at the place of employment. And, you know, we certainly could speak to that person, you know, and they're responsible for making sure they want it to work too. And, you know, any reasonable accommodations will be provided.
As we're kind of wrapping up here, is there anything that I did not ask that I should have asked?
Oh, inevitably, yes. But, you know, I think just to review, you know, transition, I'm a parent and I get it. And transition is and can be absolutely positively overwhelming. You know, it's kind of like taking that trip where you're climbing the mountain and you kept going up on the mountain, and that was either to get out of high school or get out of college. And all of a sudden you crest the mountain, and then, oh my God, beyond that is it another mountain or a series of mountains? And you thought it's all downhill from there. So again, I think start early, educate, understand, take it a piece at a time, and you can. And really understand, we all want everything to happen right away, but think about your own life, career, you know, where you learned how to maybe live on your own or how to work. And it took us time too. And it's going to take other people time. And we're interested in a career and a life path versus a snapshot that one day everything's in place, because that's not going to happen. And it didn't happen for anybody else either. So
if families have questions where to access resources or learn more about the resources in their particular state, what is your biggest suggestion for that?
You know, a couple, you know, there are really, for the first time, if you go to Maryland DDA, there is now a brand new guide that came out over the summer. I think it's the first one that the average person could read and not be thoroughly confused. So I think that's a big help. Again, with Maryland DORS, you can talk to your transition teacher as well. You can attend some of the meetings. And ultimately, you know, if you immerse yourself in this and you get confused, then, you know, I'm more than happy to help people out, you know, to really understand the particulars for their child and how it fits them.
With the Maryland DDA, does that have information on other states though?
It does not. So it is, all these services are going to be state by state.
Right.
DC has its own, Virginia has its own, but each one has companion things. So if you go to Virginia, Maryland DORS is Virginia DARS. So there's always an employment agency that, you know, is kind of a short term. And then there is a longer term support, which is a more all encompassing. And again, it would be home and community based services over in Virginia, which has different acronyms, but it's the same. In DC, same thing. The equivalent of Maryland DORS is DC RSA, but that's Rehabilitation Services Agency, I believe. But again, that is that short term employment piece. And then you look at the longer term home and community based services, which I think DC typically refers to them as waiver services. And again, there's a parallel in each place, depending upon the jurisdiction. You know, some of the guides are better than others. And certainly, I'll be honest about that. And I think that's part of the problem that sometimes people have, which is, you know, I've gone to the seminar, I've tried to read this thing, and I'm not so sure.
So if I was a parent, say in Idaho, what would be your first thing to?
So there's another resource, you know, there's a company, True North Consulting, and Eric, who really started that, he's basically tried to establish what he calls a roadmap for every state. So he's one of the few people that really is trying to give you at least some kind of a blueprint for what's available, or the universe of what's available. And that's not a bad starting point for people. Admittedly, you may look at the blueprint And that'll help you because at least it orders some things and tells you the basics. And then, of course, you're going to have a lot more questions because you say, well, okay, now I'm following the map, but I'm now at exit two. And I got a bunch of questions on exit two. But I think not a bad resource out of the blocks to at least see a continuum.
My final question, if you had a billboard for parents with one tip, what would it be and why?
I think it would be get educated because, you know, knowledge is power in general. In this area, it's kind of like the tax code, right? You know, we all go through taxes and everything else and we look at it or any complex piece like that. And you can get lost. It's like, I have no idea what they're talking about. But if you can get that education and knowledge, I dare say that this system actually makes sense. And you can dispel myths and really be even in situations where people have incomplete or wrong information and succeed over that.
I am grateful for your time and thank you for giving us some knowledge here on transition planning, and hopefully folks listening have some takeaways and know where to find you. And I'll also link the other agency that you had mentioned in our show notes for folks so that people know how to find you and get some answers to questions.
Well, I really appreciate the opportunity and your time to speak and the opportunity, as you know, somebody who's lived this system and is living it with my sons, to try to give some information that hopefully will be helpful.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thanks.
Thank you again for tuning into another episode of the Special Ed Strategist podcast. I hope you found today's podcast insightful and valuable. Before we sign off, remember to show your support by liking, sharing, and subscribing to our podcast. Your engagement helps us continue our mission of empowering families and bridging learning gaps in special education. Don't forget to spread the word about the Special Ed Strategist podcast with your friends, family, and colleagues who may benefit from our content. Together, we can make a difference in the lives of children with special needs. I am your host, Wendy Taylor, and I can't wait to bring you more inspiring content in the future. Until next time, stay informed, stay inspired, and keep making a positive impact. Goodbye for now.